This July, we celebrate the birth of our nation and remember the heroes who fought for our freedoms. But did you know there are Americans today who don't have the freedom of life and liberty? Every day, unborn babies' very lives are under attack. But because of preborn, we can rescue them.
I got to hear and see my baby for the first time. Hearing the heartbeat made me cry, and it was certain that I was going to keep my baby forever.
Ultrasounds save lives. And when you save a life at a preborn network clinic, you often save a soul, as over 85,000 women have come to know Christ. To learn more about preborn's life-saving work, call #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible. Your love can save a life.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on this edition of the program. The show's hosted each week by myself and Rick Green, or Rick Green and I to be proper. And we enjoy bringing you content and news of the week, all from a biblical perspective. That's what we do here on the program. As a reminder, we would greatly appreciate you subscribing or following the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can simply go to your podcast library, type in the name of the show, and click the subscribe button, and the podcast will be queued up in your library each and every day, and you can get the latest content directly on your mobile device. That's the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, we're going to be going to Israel and Greece back-to-back in the spring of 2026, in March of 2026. So we'll be going to Israel and Greece back-to-back, two separate trips. If you want to do one or the other, great. If you want to do both, that's great as well. You can get the dates, the itinerary, all the information over at wildmangroup.com. That's wildmangroup.com. All right, jumping into some of our news of the week that we'll cover, and we'll have on some guests here in the second segment, and then Chris will be with us in the third. But continuing this discussion that we had on Wednesday of this week regarding the rampant crime in America's inner cities, and specifically in these Democrat-run strongholds, that's the trend, is that the vast majority of these inner-city crime-infested areas are run by the Democrats. Hands down, that's what the data shows. Let's listen to clip one here. This is another D.C. resident talking about how glad she is that the National Guard has been deployed.
You hear from city leaders and others that crime is actually down. Are you seeing that?
No, I'm not seeing it. We're seeing carjackings, the violence in the communities. So we were advocating then for the National Guard to come out, but they said there was no need. But think about how many lives could have been saved just having them on the scene.
And Asya says still to this day, she's not heard from one detective about those crimes committed against her family. Now for Tempe Satcher, another D.C. resident, her son BJ was gunned down in a random drive-by shooting on the way to work 2 years ago, and she does not feel that crime has calmed down.
Just today, a young lady was shot over on 15th Street in Northeast D.C. Does that seem like crime gone down? With all the things that are going on with our president, you know, sending the National Guards out, I don't have a problem with that personally, because if MPD can't do it and they need help, then I'm glad they're able to get the help.
Well, there you have it. That is multiple residents there doing a Fox News interview talking about how glad they are that President Trump is sending reinforcements into the city of D.C., the federal city there. And what's so ironic about this is I would almost bet that those are Democrats. I would almost guarantee those are Democrats that were talking about how grateful they are that President Trump is sending in reinforcements into the District of Columbia. And you've got multiple reports. I covered Joe Scarborough just the other day talking about how behind the scenes, Democrats are thankful. They're breathing a sigh of relief that President Trump is surging in federal resources into D.C. proper to arrest the thugs and the villains. This is a good thing. Why is this controversial? Well, it's controversial because it was Donald Trump's idea, and it solves a problem. And this politicization of law and order is just crazy. It's just absolutely crazy. The fact that the government serving its core function of protecting life and property is somehow now a political issue. Somehow now it's a political issue. Absolutely crazy how we got to this point. But as I said, and Kellyanne Conway actually said the same thing just a day or two ago, but as I said earlier in the week, this is going to put the onus on the Democrats. The burden of cleaning up America's inner cities is now going to be on the Democrats. And all of this goes back to this faulty thinking, and a lot of it's rooted in much deeper, not only spiritual dynamics, but also just rotten thinking and a perverse view of man's fallenness. But just to keep it at a high level, this notion that going easy on the criminals is going to make them be less criminal is just, it's lunacy. And there's no data that backs this up. I mean, we've been doing law and order activities in our country since before 1776. I mean, the role of civil government to protect life and property has been a thing going back to prior civilizations throughout world history. This is not like new stuff where we're like, I wonder how this is going to work when we prosecute somebody for a crime. This is not a groundbreaking, new thing that a society has to deal with. And so the hard reality is that, yes, we have the breakdown of the family. That's undoubtedly driving a lot of this. You have broken homes. You have young people that are growing up in crime-infested cities, and they don't have a dad at home or they don't have a mom at home, and they're hanging out with the wrong people. Obviously, that's a root cause of a lot of this lawlessness that we're seeing, but it's not the government's job to be mommy and daddy. It's not the government's job to, quote, go easy on the criminals in hopes that they won't be criminals in the future. That's not the government's job here. We're missing the point. If we want to talk about how churches and communities and families should do a better job raising young people, let's have that conversation. I'm 100% supportive of that. But when we try to start talking as if the government can go to a granular level and become the mommy and daddy of the home, that's just not going to happen. That's not how government is set up. God did not intend government to be the family or to be the church. And so we're trying to do something that the government can't do. It just literally can't do it. It doesn't matter how much money you put into it, how many programs you put into it. The government isn't the family, and the government isn't the church. So point being, it's the government's job to punish the villain, to punish the evildoer. And then when you do that, you create a natural disincentive for future bad behavior. It's a fact. This is human psychology 101. When you punish bad behavior, you disincentivize it in the future. It doesn't mean that it's perfect. It doesn't mean that it's 100%, you know, when someone's punished, they'll never do anything bad again. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just suggesting and showing that the data on this is clear. When someone faces a punishment from the government, a civil or criminal punishment for wrongdoing and violations of our law, they will think twice before doing the bad behavior again. But when you go soft on crime, you create an incentive to bad behavior because it's not as serious for the offender in the future. The last person, the last clip I want to play this segment is one of an actual Department of Justice employee that assaulted a federal law enforcement officer in Washington, D.C. You heard that right. A DOJ employee got arrested for assaulting a Border Patrol agent in the District of Columbia in the last 48 to 72 hours. Let's listen to this Fox report, clip two.
D.C. officials say one man has been charged with a felony assault after he hurled a Subway sandwich at a border agent. Now we're learning that man allegedly walked up to those agents and called them fascists before the alleged assault. Attorney General Pam Bondi says that the suspect was actually a DOJ employee and has been promptly fired. And U.S. Attorney for Washington Jeanine Pirro sharing this message after the incident.
The president's message to the criminals was, if you spit, we hit. Well, we didn't quite do that the other night when an individual went up to one of the federal law enforcement officers and started jumping up and down, screaming at him, berating him, yelling at him. And then he took a Subway sandwich about this big and took it and threw it at the officer. He thought it was funny. Well, he doesn't think it's funny today because we charged him with a felony, assault on a police officer.
There you have it. So you can't make this stuff up. And this actually fits very well into the point I made earlier in the week about our government being full of Obama and Biden holdovers. And this is Exhibit A. Exhibit A, we have a DOJ, current DOJ, now fired and facing charges. We had, at the time, a current Department of Justice employee assault a federal law enforcement officer. And this you can't make this stuff up. And these are the people working in our government. And meanwhile, we've got the Senate slow-walking President Trump's replacements for Biden and Obama's holdovers. And we wonder what the connection is. And this is why I don't care what Senator Thune, I don't care what these guys, what excuse they want to give, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. It's not good enough. Unless you tell me that the Constitution says or the Bible says, I don't want to hear it. And so you've got how many other federal government employees are in the Department of Justice that are just like this guy. This guy's a hard lefty. And I actually know for a fact, 100%, there are current FBI agents and employees that were Biden and Obama loyalists that are still in the FBI. They're still handling cases. I know this because you've got these law firms, these pro bono religious freedom and other constitutional freedom type law firms that have been handling cases going back to Biden and his horrendous abuses of power, and they're trying to work out deals with the FBI and the DOJ, and they're dealing with Obama and Biden people. And then they get to the Trump team at the top, and the Trump team's just shocked that they still got people that are Obama and Biden loyalists still working in the agencies. And we wonder why getting these nominations through the Senate is so very important. We have to staff up the government with people who are not loyal to Biden, loyal to Obama, loyal to Donald Trump, people that are loyal to our Constitution. This is not hard stuff. This is not hard stuff. And so you've still got the Senate on vacation right now as we speak with approaching 150 nominations for the executive branches that are yet to be confirmed because the Senate Republicans decided they wanted to take a 30-day vacation, the August recess. They didn't work through it like Senator Thune threatened. And we've got how many federal government employees that are hardcore Democrat radicals that hate our country, that hate our president, and that hate our Constitution. How many more of these are out there? All the more reason that President Trump's nominees must be affirmed and confirmed in short order. We'll be back in a few minutes. We'll have Judge Phil Ginn, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, on with us to talk about the topic of marriage as an institution. We'll be back.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us today on the program. Walker Wildman here with you. As a reminder, AFR.net is where you can find out all information about the show, the podcast, and American Family Radio. You can listen live there and on the AFR app. The AFR app is free. Download it in your podcast store on your mobile device, and you can listen live and to past shows here on AFR by downloading the American Family Radio app. All right, I want to jump to our next guest, a friend of the ministry and a previous guest on the program, Judge Phil Ginn. Judge Ginn is president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, SES, and he's with us now. Judge Ginn, welcome back to the program.
Walker, it's always good to be with you. I really appreciate what you guys are doing at AFR.
Well, thank you for that compliment. I wanted to have you on to talk about the marriage institution, because this topic is as prevalent as it's ever been in American society, despite the setback that was the Obergefell ruling in 2015 and all of the lunacy that we see in society today when it comes to the LGBTQ plus agenda. A lot of people, I believe, are waking up to the reality that this wild west of human sexuality that we've embraced, and this denial of God's created order that we've also embraced, is taking us down a path that none of us want. So talk about that.
Well, obviously, there is a culture war going on. There's a war within the culture, and there's a war of the culture against true faith. And it's invaded the church. There are two institutions which are very crucial to Christian life. One is the church, and the other is the family. And the family was the first. That's what God put together. And at SES, we recognize that those two institutions are in great danger in our nation, and probably in the world as well. And one of the ways that it's really a Marxist theology, if you will, and one of the ways they attack us is based on either race or sex. And they're doing really, really well in both areas right now. It's so important to us that we are really organizing our entire apologetics conference in October 10 and 11 around this concept. And it's not a marriage seminar. It's not a how to treat your family better. It's really looking at what we as Christians can do to protect the marriage and the family institution that we have in this nation. This is not a game. Walker, this is serious business, because if our families are destroyed, and it's not just homosexuality, transgenderism, it's divorce, it's single mothers. And
hey, Judge Ginn, are you still there? All right, I think we lost Judge Ginn. Maybe he'll come back in with the connection here shortly. But what he's talking about is their conference they have coming up in October, October 10th and 11th in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And the topic is just what Judge Ginn's talking about there. The topic is marriage and family. This conference is brought to you by Southern Evangelical Seminary, ses.edu. And this this marriage and family topic, folks, is one thing we have to do better when talking about this is go beyond the two adults that are consenting to the relationship, that are consenting to the union, that are consenting to the bond that is marriage. Because there are so many downstream and really direct, more than downstream, I would say direct consequences one way or the other to the marital relationship. Obviously, the marital relationship by definition is that which is between a man and a woman within the confines of marriage. That's the marital relationship by definition. There is no marriage outside of that, but even though they want to pretend that. But there are so many things, people and institutions that are affected by the marital relationship. And so it's so much more than just what do two adults want to do. There's so much more at play here. I think we have Judge Ginn back with us. Judge Ginn, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry for the whatever electrical snafu. It's probably the demons in the system don't want us to talk about this, Walker.
Yeah, maybe so. This is definitely something that Satan doesn't want us to talk about, and that is the truth of the scripture. Judge Ginn, you were talking about the importance of the marital institution and how this is and the point I was just making in the break there is about this has so much more direct effect than just what does a man and a woman want to do, or what do two men want to do. This has ramifications on society, on children, and on everyone else in the culture.
Well, it's the basis of God's kingdom plan here on this earth. It's the very core of what we do. If you look at this whole concept of the love of God and the acceptance of God, and the homosexuals are telling us that we need to accept them the way they are, that God made them that way. But that's not what God does. God does not accept us the way we are. In fact, God accepts us despite the way we are. And it's only because he accepts us in Christ and Christ alone, but he never intends us to leave us that way. And so if we look at this concept of love and the different definitions of love that we find in the New Testament, it's interesting that when Paul wrote Ephesians 5, which has to do with the relationship between man and woman, he used the Greek word for love that's basically shows God's love, which is, I've heard it pronounced a couple of different ways. It's either agape or agape, whichever you look at it. Hmm. And then he really references that as symbolic of Christ's relationship with his church. So again, the family is relating to the church. And if you go all the way over into Revelation, you find it right again that God is the great marriage supper of the Lamb. And so it's at the core of what God's teachings are for us here as Christians. And it was true in biblical days, and it's certainly more true now for us than ever before.
Judge Ginn, let's once again, we're talking to Judge Phil Ginn with Southern Evangelical Seminary, president there, about the topic of marriage and family, which is the topic of their conference, October 9th through 11th. Judge Ginn, talk about the role of government here, because some folks want to make this argument, well, this isn't really the government's business, even though nobody said that, you know, for the past 2,000 or really longer than that, since the dawn of creation, nobody said this isn't the government's business. It has been the government's business. The government has played a role in recognizing marital unions between a man and a woman in this country since its founding and before. But talk about the role of government here, because the government either consents or doesn't consent to certain behaviors and certain relationships.
Walker, I think you've got to go even further than that. I think there's been a disconnect already between government and the people, and it's based on the lack of morality within the people. Our form of republic democracy will not continue to exist without morality. That's what it was based on. It's based on the traditional morality that Christianity comes. If Christianity is not the if America is not a Christian country, and I would probably argue that certainly right now it's not, then Christianity through the years has in fact been the conscience of the nation. And the government is no better than the morality that is that comes and emanates from its populace. And in that regard, government does have a great role in maintaining the morality that should be its basis.
Yeah,
and
that's
when we break that connection between the morality of the people who are being governed and the government, then government is going to either be laissez-faire in regard to controlling what's going on, or, as I would submit in the case of our government right now, they're going to be working against the very morality that causes them to exist to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. To your point, our government today in many regards is consenting to the ungodliness and giving affirmation to it.
It's pushing it. We've gone beyond permissiveness to promoting it.
Yes.
In our nation. And you know, Walker, I put a lot of the blame on that in the churches in America. If you look at churches in America, statistics will show you right now that less than 6% of the people who fill up a pew in a church on Sunday morning actually have a biblical worldview. And you go even further than that, and I'm going to give you the positive statistic. 51% of our pastors have a biblical worldview. If our pastors do not have a biblical worldview, if the shepherds are not leading the sheep, then how in the world do we expect the sheep to know where to go?
Amen.
Let me give you one other statistic. Less than 6% of the churches in America have an effective discipleship program. Did you know that a majority of church members in America can't even tell you what the Great Commission is? So if we don't get those basics right, how can we defend the family, Walker? Because we're talking about defending the family on a biblical basis, the biblical concept of family. And if we don't have that concept in the hearts and minds of our church people, of our so-called Christians, maybe it's not a trans Christian problem. We got a lot of people self-identifying as Christians who aren't really.
Amen. Hey, Judge Ginn, tell us the URL to find more information about your conference.
Go to ses.edu. It's our website, and you can find out everything you want to know there. By the way, it's filling up fast, and we've got some great presenters there, some great breakout sessions that we're going to have, and some great plenary sessions that folks won't want to miss. And there's lots of other things coming from out of SES these days, Walker. We're really trying to look at bringing training to everyday people. We're great in academics. We're rated in the top 10 seminaries in the country for apologetics. And I would suggest to you, we may be number one in terms of folks who aren't woke. And we're sticking right to the Bible, and that's a hill we'll die on, Walker. And, you know, I just urge people to take a look at us and look for things that are to come, because I believe your listeners are going to be excited about some of the things that you're going to be seeing coming out of SES in the next few weeks and months.
Amen. Hey, Judge Ginn, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Walker, thank you so much. Sorry for the little glitch, but let's do it more often, man. I love to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad we got it worked out. Thanks, Judge. That's Judge Phil Ginn, president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. SES.edu is their URL, SES.edu. Right there on the top right-hand corner, you'll see their conference link, Apologetics Conference, coming up October 10th and 11th in South Carolina. And one of the speakers is our very own M.D. Perkins, producer of Culture Warrior, and also producer and director of other films that we've produced as well, including The God Who Speaks. M.D. Perkins will be speaking at this conference, along with a great lineup of others as well. The topic is marriage and family. Very, very fitting. We've got to take this topic back, and I'm just telling you, we're not waiting 40 to 50 years to overturn Obergefell like we did Roe. We're just not waiting that long. I mean, this year is the 10-year anniversary. We actually just went past the 10-year anniversary of Obergefell. And it's a travesty, and it's creating victims every day. Victims in children and victims in adults. and the victims and children is the one I care about. I care about both. I care about the eternal state and the eternal soul of the adults and the children that are marred by this sexual confusion. But I have a especially soft spot for the children because they didn't sign up for this, and they're being victimized by this radical sexual agenda that is responsible for the mass sexualization of children who ought not be doing anything or hearing anything or experiencing anything of this sort at the age. And this has created the Wild West of adoption and surrogacy, and it's terrible. It's terrible. The horror stories are plentiful. And so we've got to get this Obergefell overturned. There is no such thing as, quote, same-sex marriage or whatever else they want to call it or whatever other marriages they want to pretend to have. There's no such thing. This is a human construct. I'm talking about this pretending that two men can be engaged in a marital union. This is purely a marital construct that has no legal or moral basis. And it should be dissolved and abolished and put in the history books as the worst idea a civilization ever tried. And so we're not waiting 40 or 50 years to overturn Obergefell. The effort starts now, and it starts with Matt Staver's latest suit on behalf of Kim Davis. We interviewed Matt earlier, or within the last week or two, on the topic. It starts with appealing to the courts, to the government, and to the populace that this is a travesty, it's bad, it's creating victims, it's terrible for society, terrible for humans, terrible for families, terrible for children, terrible for adults. It's bad all the way around. There's nothing good about it. And the biggest lie we ever told ourselves is this is just about two consenting adults. No, hogwash. That's not true. This was never about two consenting adults. They already got rid of Lawrence v. Texas. So two consenting adults theoretically could have done whatever they wanted to prior to Obergefell. No. This was about getting the government to give a thumbs up to their sinful relationships, their unnatural relationships, and then allow them to victimize children. That's what this was about.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. Last segment now underway. Chris Woodward is in with us. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, I want to jump to this Census Bureau discussion that I came across this week.
Okay.
There was a pretty big debate, and there was some litigation going back to 2019 and 2020 regarding the 2020 census.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, this would have been right after President Trump, towards the latter part of President Trump's administration and the beginning of President Biden's administration.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2020, 2021. But the Census Bureau later came out after the census was done, the 2020 census, and informed us that they counted illegal immigrants. And so that altered congressional districts, gave the Democrats more seats and more electoral college votes. And President Trump is committing to fixing it in the 2030 census, which assumes that a Republican has control of the executive branch in 2030.
Mm-hmm.
But let's play this clip. This is from, let me get this right, Center for Renewing America, Wade Miller.
Okay.
With the gentleman, goodness, I'm having a blank. The budget OMB director, Russ Vought. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is Russ Vought's nonprofit and one of his researchers, Wade Miller, talking about the Census Bureau overcounting for the Democrats in these blue states. Let's listen.
If you republish the 2020 data, account for the miscounts, the overcounts, the undercounts, which, by the way, across the board helped the left in 2020. The Census Bureau admitted that they got it really wrong. It was the worst census in our lifetimes, I believe. The 1991 was not great either, but this one, I think, by far outstrips it. In 2010, they were off by 36,000. In 2020, in Texas alone, they were off by 560,000. So it was just a terribly run census. And if you account for all of those corrections, if you account for swings and voter tendencies, especially amongst Hispanics, if you account for the illegal population, and then you republish those maps and then mandate a reapportionment, that will then bleed into redistricting. If you know where the illegal populations are and you don't count the illegal populations for the purposes of redistricting, it pushes political power into rural red areas because the vast majority of these illegal populations, especially in blue states, are in major cities or suburbs of major cities. So it makes it harder for Gavin Newsom and the left to write these maps because the population, the weighted population, moves out from the cities slightly or significantly in the case of California. So it's just harder for them to write a map that accounts for all of that, that benefits them. It's a much harder road for them to do that. And if they republish the census and then mandate reapportionment, it takes the ball out of Gavin Newsom's hand. And he's sure, you can go ahead and redistrict. But good luck doing that. You know, they might actually end up with fewer Democrat seats if you republish the 2020 census and they still try to redistrict.
So Chris, this is the battle. And yes. I don't want people to miss this. The battle is ultimately going to be over, and this is a legal and constitutional battle. I'm not talking about redistricting. I'm talking about counting illegal immigrants. Mm-hmm. Everybody redistricts. Every state redistricts. Democrats do it. Republicans do it. And I love how the Democrats are squawking about Texas doing it, and then to respond, they say, "Well, we'll do it."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, y'all do it. Y'all have been doing it. This is not a new thing, a new threat. Y'all been gerrymandering since forever. Yeah. This goes back a couple hundred years, and so. But the point is, Chris, Democrats are scared that they're going to lose a lot of seats.
Yes.
Because they've rigged the census and they've gerrymandered into oblivion and they're scared about it.
Well, and it brings into question, if you'll rig a census, and you clearly have, what else have you rigged? Or what yes. other numbers have you fudged with and made to benefit your cause or your caucus here? I mean, leave it to government to screw something up.
Yes.
And here clearly they did yet again.
The Census Bureau, by the way, Chris, answers this question on their website about counting foreign-born mm-hmm. individuals. And the answer that it gives, now they've since taken this down, which I think is funny, but this is archived in on the internet. Mm-hmm. And when asked the question, the census says, yes, the U.S. Census Bureau collects data from all foreign-born who participate in its censuses and surveys regardless of legal status. Mm-hmm. So this is no, well, did they or did they not? No, they counted all the illegals in the census.
Yeah, and that's ammunition for the people that said Biden let all these people in here because he was trying to rig the next election or future elections by having these people vote.
Valid point.
And here's the thing. If Trump was to republish this census, they need to come out with a really good message and stay on that message as to why they're going to do it, because Gavin Newsom is going to come out in some sort of sore throat voice saying he's messing with the numbers and he doesn't want to count diversity.
Well, he's doing it now. Did you watch his rally?
I did, and yeah. I was going to get there too. I chuckled and laughed out loud. Honestly did when I heard him say from Los Angeles that in California we embrace diversity, and this is a man that has surrounded himself with yes men.
Yes.
If you were really diverse, Gavin Newsom, you would have people in your group telling you, hey, Gavin, don't do that.
Right.
But he doesn't do that.
All he sees is skin color.
And that's the difference with Trump. I mean, this particular cabinet is diverse ideologically. When you have people like Tulsi Gabbard in there, you've got Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
You've got a pro-union labor secretary.
Yes.
Like former union leader.
Yeah, and there
which
are
is
people,
not a Republican thing.
Yeah, and there are people in the administration that maybe are doing things in their personal lifestyle we don't agree with.
Right.
But it goes to show you the point I'm trying to make here is that Trump himself embraces diversity.
True. Yeah,
whereas
true
Newsom
diversity.
Is just, yeah, Gavin, go for it. That's yeah. And that's why California looks the way it does.
Yeah, they're not diverse. They're ideological, like, replicates. And anybody who counters what, who goes off the rails or goes off the talking points.
You're canceled.
Yeah, of Gavin Newsom, you're done for. There is no ideological diversity, which is what the true diversity we're talking about is. And they don't want to have debates either. They want to cancel people and shut people down. Mm-hmm. But I just want to let people know this is the battle. So don't get distracted over the headlines. Don't get distracted over what is gerrymandering. No, this is about Democrats are literally panting right now that they're going to lose control, more control of the congressional seats and electoral college votes because they've been rigging it and we're on to them now and we're going to fix it and. They can't fathom that.
Yes. And meanwhile, the so-called party of unity that 10 years ago was saying love Trump's hate, they're now out there with people like J.B. Pritzker, saying things like, we're going to mess with Texas. Like it's 1860-something. It's 2025. And this guy wants to run for president, we think. You can't be out there talking like that when you've got people on Fox going, we need a centrist or we're going to lose future elections.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they got this New York guy and this Minnesota guy.
Bless his heart.
Yeah, and the Minneapolis mayor candidate. I mean, this is bad news.
I don't know whether or not.
And then you got O'Rourke's making a comeback.
Yeah, I don't know whether or not Mamdani is a socialist or a communist, but he's un-American
to me.
With the things that he's pushing out there.
Yeah.
People need to care about. I know sometimes people think, well, New York City, California, who cares?
Right.
You need to care because New York City is a financial capital of the world. We sometimes pound our chest and think it's number one. London would like to have a word.
Yeah.
But New York City, there's a lot of financial stuff going on there. California is a massive economy. We can't just let them walk. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things. The worse they leave or take their place, the worse we all are. You know, we're impacted by that too, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I don't know, Chris. This just seems like we're going in two different directions.
We are.
I mean, parts of the country are becoming more conservative, and other parts of the country are becoming more radical.
Well, and one of those parts of the country that's becoming more conservative was that one, and we've talked about it on the show. We did the stories on AFN.net. There's probably still videos out there from the Associated Press on this. After the election last year, it was determined that there was a majority, like overwhelming majority, Hispanic county in Texas that had never voted Republican.
They went for Trump.
Yeah, and it voted because of things like immigration and trade and business and all these other things. So that goes to show you where people – it proved your point that people in rural areas – are leaning towards the right in their policies here, which is what Charlie Kirk and other people have been saying for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, is listening to the program or not, but he talked specifically about the housing crisis that you and I have talked about frequently on the program, the unaffordability crisis in the housing sector. He was on with Maria Bartiromo, so let's listen to what he says about his future plans for the housing crisis.
The housing market is obviously very important in the U.S. We've got an affordability crisis. So there are two pieces here, Maria. How can we maximize the value for the U.S. taxpayer with Fannie and Freddie? On the other side, how can we keep mortgage rates, the spread between mortgages and treasuries flat, or even bring that down to address this terrible affordability crisis in housing that developed during the Biden administration?
It seems like you're going to have big demand for those stakes in Fannie and Freddie. A lot of viewers wanted to know about that.
They're very unique companies. And again, you know, they sit in the middle of the U.S. housing ecosystem. And you know, I think you're going to see, I know you're going to see over the coming months and quarters, this administration now that you know, we're doing peace deals, trade deals, tax deals. We are really going to work on this housing affordability crisis. That's one of my big projects for the fall, along with several other branches of government.
Well, there you have it. So this is apparently going to be a focus in the next few months.
Yeah, it would be a good idea, and maybe they have this plan, but it would be good if, like, HUD Secretary Scott Turner had some state-level HUD people to the White House or somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe meet in the middle of the country for a sit-down on what the federal and state governments need to do to help this, because it is a bipartisan problem. Government, especially in blue states, makes it very difficult to build anything. Whether or not they're trying to save some frog that we've never heard of on some plot of land, or
the, oh, the whatever, environmental regs are absurd.
I mean, government is largely the problem. And I know I don't want to come on here and always sound anti-government, but government is largely the problem when it comes to the housing problem because they've made it incredibly difficult to build things and build more things. There's I mean, you can't build certain kind of houses. Then you've got people in certain neighborhoods that don't want multi-housing units or whatever, all these things.
Yeah.
Government is largely the problem there, which is why we need everybody to have a powwow to figure out what to do. And also, the administration needs to really get out there, and maybe they can get Mike Rowe involved. There is nothing wrong with slinging a hammer and putting some shingles on top of a roof, because to hear the left, we're going to be short in that area now that people who are here illegally have been sent back home.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that the government needs to do to fix the problem that the government has caused in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, they got to get just all overall pricing down, including new build pricing.
Yes.
New build pricing is still too high. They've got to get pricing down. And this whole housing shortage, I'm almost so tired of hearing it. It's like, we've been doing this for 20 years, a housing shortage. And at what point are we not going to have a housing shortage?
Right.
I mean, build the houses, but we keep having these cycles brought to you by modern monetary theory and debt that are making people get in and out of the building sector.
Yeah, I mean, housing it's a problem, and really, the sooner we can get it resolved, the better, because we've talked about this. If somebody's buying a house and there is a legit housing shortage, then things are going to be built. Things are going to be made to build those things. People are going to be hired to use those tools. It's an economic problem. It could be solved. It doesn't have to take 10 or 15 years like the government sometimes slowballs a project into being.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not just mortgage rates. It's Bessent was talking about insurance later in that interview too.
Yes,
premiums are up. I mean, these people that live in Florida and California, whether it's hurricanes or wildfires, I mean, they're just being hit hard,
right,
by these insurance premiums.
And I wouldn't rule out people in less weather affected areas having to pay higher prices because their insurance company
Does business both
places.
They
lost its shirt, you know, out west or over in the east.
So they're going to make it up on us.
Right. So you might live in a very you might live in a place that isn't necessarily as big a risk, but you know, it's a problem. And it's a problem that, again, could be fixed if we just actually put our minds to it and not necessarily focus on other topics of the day.
Yeah, we need stability, and Jerome Powell is just going to have to go. I think his term ends in 26, less than a year, and he's going to have to go.
I'm curious to see who the president would put in that position. I think, obviously, he's probably already got somebody in mind. He certainly wanted Jerome Powell gone since Trump re-entered office, pretty much. I would guess that Trump is going to get somebody in there that would be open to lowering the rates. Why on earth would you appoint somebody that's not going to do it?
No, he's going to get somebody that's going to do it. He's going to have to get the rest of the governors on board, though.
Yeah.
Now, you got two dissenters already.
He might, you know, hey, you want to come on up and have this job?
He actually had two dissenting votes.
Yes.
And then he just got a new seat replacement that was a Biden appointee. So that's going to be three, let's say, Trump-aligned votes.
Yep.
Plus the chairman,
and
the new chairman.
Interest rates affects everybody listening to our voices.
Yeah, they got to get them down. They've been up too long, too high, unnecessarily. And the Fed didn't cause inflation. Washington, D.C.'s printing press did. And that's going to be what fixes it. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.